As we head into the second half of the year, the Delta COVID variant is causing consternation in markets, with recent flare-ups in Asia, now the US, and here at home, a stark reminder that we are not yet out of the pandemic woods. Market participants are also keenly awaiting the Fed minutes later today. Minutes of the Fed's June policy meeting were eagerly anticipated because it might show how serious members were about tapering their asset buying and how early hikes could begin. Oil has come off overnight, but the market is still skittish following tensions inside OPEC Plus. Brent up 44% year to date as seaborne coal prices also soar, as images of burning seas and heat domes in the Northern Hemisphere are certainly not preventing a surge in fossil fuel prices, reminding us that Glasgow might be little more than a talk shop later on in the year. And in company news, Jeff Bezos is certainly feeling post-Prime Day nostalgia. Amazon's founder has officially stepped down as CEO after 27 years at the helm. The Zon has come a long way since 1995, when he sold the site's first book from his Seattle garage. Bezos had left a cushy hedge fund job to take a risk on his e-commerce idea, saying, "Even if I fail, I wouldn't have had any regrets." Well, spoiler alert, he certainly didn't fail, now the world's richest man. Let's find out what the animal spirits are telling us with Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, good to see you again. The COVID situation with this Delta variant appears to be worsening in parts of the world. In Tokyo, the Olympics look under threat. Here, the British and Irish Lions tour looks under threat. It really is a stark reminder that we're not yet out of those pandemic woods. What are the global numbers telling us?
Good afternoon, Michael. Yeah, you're completely correct. If we look at the global seven-day average, it's now stopped declining. We had a good patch for the past couple of months where we had consistent declines in the number of new infections, and now it's plateaued at around 380,000 infections per day. It's actually up 3% week on week. And if we look at countries around the world, the vast majority have seen an increase. The US, Europe, the UK, incidentally, has a greater number of infections than South Africa, and their growth rate is faster, despite the vaccine rollout. So we are seeing an uptick in the numbers. But what's interesting is if you look at the countries that have so far successfully rolled out their vaccine program, those countries, despite the fact they're seeing an increase in the number of infections, are not seeing a material increase in the number of hospitalizations, the number of fatalities. So in some sense, the vaccine rollout is working. People are getting it, but they're not getting it to the extent, or they're not getting sick enough to the extent that they need to go to hospital and place a burden on the healthcare facilities. And as a result, despite the fact that people are getting sick, there's no need at that point for some form of lockdown and economically damaging restriction on mobility. The net result is the numbers that are going to be most important going forward over the coming 12 months are not the number of new infections. We're going to have to shift our emphasis to the vaccine rollout in particular, and it'll become secondary, the number of people that are infected. What matters now is the number of people that are going to hospital and the number of people that are passing away.
Absolutely, because then we start talking about turning this from a pandemic into an epidemic. It becomes manageable with that vaccination and nothing more than some kind of seasonal influenza that we've been dealing with for decades. Now, in South Africa, the numbers are steadily increasing, but the pace does feel less aggressive than we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. What are you tracking? And also on the vaccine front, it was encouraging yesterday to see a record 166,000 vaccines administered. So we are improving. I still can't understand why we're not vaccinating over the weekend, though.
Yeah, completely correct. And if we look at our seven-day average, it's picking up at around about 1% per week, which is roughly in line with what the US is doing at this point and roughly in line with the global average. The problem is that we've only vaccinated just over 5% of our population so far. The global average is at around 25%. Europe is a bit above that. The US is a bit above that. And the UK is over 60%. So we've got Europe on the one hand, which have already vaccinated 40% of their population, and they're vaccinating 2% per week, and they're catching up to the US very rapidly. And us, on the other hand, we're just over 5% and we're growing at 1%. There's lots of scope for growth. And the current trajectory, it's going to take us about a year before we get to herd immunity. But with the current trajectory, it's probably not appropriate at all, because we are expecting a ramp up quite shortly, which means that we've got this issue with us for, call it, the next 9 months, if we need a base case forecast. And the rest of the world has got this issue for the next month or two, before we can start to focus on other things rather than the COVID rollout in particular.
So sick and tired of talking about COVID. I'm sure everyone is at the moment. Another 9 months, that's potentially another two wave, certainly another one wave that business and the economy has to deal with. Ahead of the Fed minutes, we're still fixated on inflation, and in particular, you track core inflation over in the US. So what is that telling you about the transitory or otherwise nature of this particular bout of inflation?
Yeah, the global focus is now shifting from the COVID pandemic to inflation and the consequences of the government support that we've seen during the pandemic. And one of this is what's known as core PCE inflation. And this is the series that the Fed tracks. They don't look at headline inflation. They focus on another series which is more stable. They strip out the volatile components, and it gives a better indication of underlying inflation. And this series has been picking up fairly aggressively in the US. The Fed targets an average of 2% for core PCE inflation. They don't say over what period it should average 2%, and they don't say at what point, if it's above 2%, that they get uncomfortable. If it's 3 or 4 or 5%, they've given no guidance around that. So they've given themselves some room to maneuver. But it's important to track the series nonetheless. And the latest print is for core PCE inflation in the US is running at 3.4%, so well above the 2% target. And it's been high partly due to base effects, what was happening this time last year, but not completely due to base effects. If you look at the month-on-month increases, for May, that was 0.5%. Now, they're targeting 2% over a 12-month window. It went up by 0.5% in 1 month alone. And it's been growing so aggressively over the past couple of months. And in fact, it's caught up for the long period. The core PCE inflation was below the Fed's 2% target. It had been below fairly consistently since December 2018. It's caught back all of that. So average core PCE inflation from December 2018 through to now is actually above 2%. So the current number is above 2%. It's caught up with what it had lost out over the past couple of years. So the average is around 2%. It looks, if we were backward looking, like the inflation box has already been ticked for the Fed. But then you need to look at the forward-looking numbers. And you mentioned that the minutes are coming out from the latest FOMC meeting. At the time, they actually released their forecast. Every single one of the FOMC members raised their inflation forecast at the last meeting. Every single one also said that the inflation trajectory is more uncertain now than is traditionally the case. And a large number of them said that the risk to their forecast is for inflation to rise rather than be below their forecast. That is, that there's a risk that it's going to exceed what they were expecting. So you've got the Fed, which is forecasting PCE inflation to be above 2% for the foreseeable horizon. It's already above 2%. It's been above 2% before. In broad summary, inflation is not a concern for the Fed at this point anymore. That box is ticked. And the only reason that they're not hiking at this point is for other things, like employment. But if it was solely down to inflation, they would be hiking already.
Considering all of that, did the tone of the last Fed meeting and that hawkish tone surprise you? Because it did seem to catch quite a few market participants offside, that the fact that it was now penciling in two 25 bip rate increases in 2023 and bringing that forward a little bit.
Now, they're going to have to become increasingly hawkish. I mean, it was a surprise to the market when they were talking about 2023. But if you look at the current trajectory for inflation and employment, which we'll touch on shortly, it's quite reasonable to expect, in fact, that they'll hike middle of next year. So we can expect them to become increasingly hawkish over the next few meetings. And in addition to talking about when they're going to hike, they're going to have to talk about when they're going to taper, and they'll provide more guidance on that. And the consensus forecast in the market is that tapering will occur somewhere around Q4 this year. So they'll start to provide guidance on that quite soon. And so we can expect an incrementally more hawkish Fed over the coming few meetings. I don't think that would be a surprise, certainly not a surprise to us, although perhaps it would be a surprise to the market.
Well, there are some in the market. I was chatting to the guys at Marriott who are talking about fading the reflation trade or the inflation trade. They think it's certainly transitory from here. Where do you sit on the spectrum? From BlackRock's Larry Fink, we're heading for once-in-a-generation inflation, the likes of which we've never seen before, to Jay Powell, there's nothing to see here. It's only transitory.
Well, we're somewhere between the two. We like to get some sort of base case forecast to try to get a reasonable estimate of where inflation is going and and how long it's going to remain above 2%. And we put in some fairly conservative estimates. We take the current trajectory and we say, well, let's assume for the next 11 months or so that the month-on-month increases in core PCE are in line with the last decade or so. Now, that's a conservative estimate because there's good reason to believe that the month-on-month increases, in fact, are going to be above over what we've seen over the past decade. And there's reasons from the housing market, which we can touch on. There's reasons from employment, which we can touch on. But nonetheless, just conservatively say that over the coming 11 months, we're going to get normal month-on-month increases. Well, if we do that, given that we've already seen some pretty sizable increases over the past couple of months, even with normal increases over the next 11 months, core PCE inflation will remain above 2%. So it's going to be above 2% for the foreseeable future. So it's quite different from the situation that we had from around 2010 through to now, where we had consistently low inflation. The key theme in the market was disinflation and deflation. Yeah. We're in a different scenario completely. Now, whether that means we're going to see inflation of 6 or 7%, we're not there either. We would need to see some pretty sizable traction in inflation before we'd be willing to be convinced of that argument. Up until now, over the past 6 months, companies have been guiding to us that they're increasing their prices at a rate that we haven't seen since 1990. And despite all of that, we're still seeing core PCE inflation still only just above 3%. So on the one hand, you're quite correct. We've got some pretty wild forecasts on where inflation is going to go, and those are based on the massive increase in money supply that we've seen. We've got the argument that no, within a few months it's going to be below 2%. We're somewhere between the two. And that's simply based on the data and the trends that we currently observe.
That's such an important conversation. I know we talk about it all the time, but it really is. It links through to the US federal fund interest rate, and it really is the number one issue for markets because it's the reference price against which all other asset classes are benchmarked effectively and priced at. And there are ways to play it. In this moderately rising inflation environment, getting back into financials, that would certainly be an interesting way to play as well. Now, let's come back to the housing market. We've spoken about the relative strength of the US housing market before. Buyers willing to name their firstborns after the sellers. What are you tracking as we head into the second half? Does that sort of strength continue? What does that mean for the strength or otherwise weakness of the US consumer? How are you reading it?
The housing market in the US is just extraordinarily strong. And this is the defining characteristic between this crisis and the global financial crisis. There are a number of indicators out there. I mean, the fortunate thing with the US is that there's a wealth of data that one can use to analyze any given metric in the US economy. And housing, based on the benchmark indices, is up about 15% year on year. That's house prices. However, there are some other high frequency indicators which suggest that there's likely been an uptick. And in fact, house prices are up around 20% year on year. So the reality is going to be somewhere between the two, houses up 15 to 20%. And the reason that's significant is twofold. First of all, Americans, like consumers in a number of other economies, use their homes to extract home equity to go and purchase. So there's a wealth effect. And as house prices pick up, consumers tend to spend more. And in addition to that, we know that there's a large savings stockpile still in the US and in a number of other countries. And what this tells us is that there's a tailwind for consumer spend over the coming 11 to 12 months. Good news. The other side of the sword, though, is that with an increase in house prices, typically 12 months later, there's an increase in rent. And rent is 33% of the CPI basket, and it's around 20% of core PCE. So as rent prices go up, we'll start to see an increase in core inflation numbers. And those are the sort of numbers that get the Fed twitchy, given the discussion that we've just had. And so what it implies is, in shorthand, certainly over the next 12 months, we can expect an improvement in consumer spending. But with that comes a risk that inflation is a bit more sticky. And while the Fed allows employment to get back to normal levels and they keep rates low until the middle of next year or so, that means that we've got this build-up inflation, and when they do start to hike, they have to act quite aggressively. And so I think that's a reasonable base case, that is that the Fed keeps rates low while inflation runs hot, but then the inflation pressures build up because of rent and other stories that we'll mention now as well. And then when they do hike, they have to do it in such a way that it is disruptive for markets. And that is something that we need to keep a very close eye on. It means that they won't be smoothly increasing rates. Instead, there'll be a jump and a set of fairly rapid increases when they do start to hike.
And that'll cause a massive correction and ripples throughout global markets. Another sign of inflation building up in the system is what's going on in global shipping. And I love the Baltic Dry Index as a gauge of global trade. it's up more than oil this year. What's driving this? I've heard a lot about container shortages. Is that the big issue? How are you reading it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are container issues. So it's a supply issue. There's an increase in demand globally. People want stuff that's shipped out of China in particular. And China is looking still to suck in goods from the rest of the world. So the Baltic Dry is an indication of the cost of shipping dry goods across the Pacific, so corn and iron ore. And that series is up 100% year on year. It costs a lot to get stuff through to China, not because there's a shortage of ships. Equally, it costs a lot to get stuff out of China. You can look at containerized freight indices. They're also up 100% year on year. And it also suggests that companies are going to land up in a position where their costs are going up and they have to attempt to pass it on to consumers or take it in the margin. And the net result of that is, sure, it's a strong economic environment, but in the back of our minds, we do have to recognize that there are a number of indicators out there, some of supply linked, some linked to housing, some linked to wages, which do point to an environment of higher inflation than we've been used to over the past 5 years or so.
Yeah, that's the issue. It's not just a single data point. There's several very interesting and very influential data points in housing, in shipping, in wages, all of this coming through the system. Speaking of wages, last Friday's jobs report, it was seen as a bit of a Goldilocks number, kind of just right. And I'm not exactly sure why. The US economy created 850,000 jobs. It was ahead of consensus, which was 720,000, and probably about four times more than we would expect at this phase of a normal recovery. Hawkish to you?
When we looked at the data, the market reaction was surprising. From our perspective, it was a number that was better than the consensus forecast. And as a result, we would have thought that market participants would bring forward the point at which the Fed hikes, given that employment really is the sole reason that the Fed isn't hiking at this point. And it was a number that was above consensus. If we look at other high-frequency data indicators for employment, like PMIs, for some time, they've indicated that employment is growing very aggressively. But over the past couple of months, those employment numbers have disappointed. The formal numbers have disappointed in the US. So what it tells us is that the high frequency stuff was probably correct, and we're seeing a bit of a correction in the formal numbers, and they're catching up to what's actually occurring in the economy, and the US is adding a lot of jobs. Now, there's still some way to go. Total employment in the US at this point is still about 4.5% off pre-COVID levels. But based on the trajectory over the past couple of months, they're going to get back to where they were within the next 12 months. And at that point, we'll have inflation above 2%, the average above 2%, the forecast above 2%, employment back to where it was, and US GDP at that point will be well above pre-COVID levels as well. So there'll be absolutely no obstacle to the Fed hiking should these trends continue for the next 12 months. And it's something that we need to be absolutely concerned about, but it's something that the market is not concerned about. And that is a bit of a mystery at this point.
A bit of a mystery, but also an opportunity for investors as well, which is what makes markets. It's great to be watching the Euros again. Full stadia, life looking like it's returning to normal, Italy winning on penalties. What impact is this having on tourism around the world?
We track global tourism fairly carefully for two reasons. One, it's a fairly large part of global GDP. For a number of countries, it's about 2 to 4%, and actually there's a small number of countries where it's around 10% of GDP, if we think of a country like Spain as an example. And so it's pretty important from a growth perspective, but also it plays an outsized part in employment. Around 10% of the labor force pre-COVID in the US was employed in hotel and leisure, despite the fact that it was only around 2.5% of US GDP. So we need to keep a close eye on it, and the numbers there are very encouraging. The number of people passing through TSA security, that is getting on a plane, over the last week were above 2 million. The 7-day average was above 2 million for the first time post-COVID. It's still about 14% of 2019 levels, but it's growing by 17% month on month. So it tells us within a month, the number of people getting on a plane flying around the US are going to be back at normal levels. And if we look at hotel occupancy in the US, for two of the past three weekends, hotel occupancy was actually above 2019 levels. Now, the 7-day average is still a bit below, but also within the next month, we'd expect to get to back to normal levels of tourism measured by both flights and hotel occupancy in the US in particular, which means in a few months after that, we'll end up with very aggressive hiring in that space once companies are confident that it's likely to stick. So very good news in the US. The news in Europe is less good, partly because of lockdowns and they've been slower to recover. Mm-hmm. But if you look at hotel occupancy in London as an example, it's only just above 30%. Although it's interesting there, it looks like short-term rentals like Airbnb have taken a lot of market share from the hotels, and actually short-term rentals are back in line with pre-COVID levels already. It's just the formal space that's taking a lot longer to recover. But nonetheless, hotel occupancy in London, well below where it was pre-COVID, and in Europe, massively below. I mean, if we think of Berlin as an example, hotel occupancy is in the mid-teens there at this point. So a hang of a long way to go before it gets back to normal. So US leading the charge, people out and about spending, they're on holidays almost now like they were before. Within the next month, it'll be just like they were before. For Europe, they've got a long way to go. For parts of China, they're actually back in line with where they were before, but other parts where there's been a full lockdown, still a massively long way to go.
Yeah.
Now, in broad summary, the recent data coming out, the consensus view was it would take 3 to 4 years for total hotel occupancy, global hotel occupancy, to get back to normal. It looks like we're running about a year ahead of schedule at this point, which is quite interesting.
Right, so 2 to 3 years then. And I was reading an interesting report. Sadly, South Africa will feel the economic impact of the near disappearance of our international tourism more keenly than almost all other countries, according to a new UN report. And the reasons being are fairly obvious. We're far away from some of the key tourist markets. We're poorly vaccinated still at this stage. And we have all of those structural issues around our tourism sector as well to deal with. So sadly, not looking good for South Africa. Now, I've been surprised by the disconnect in Chinese equity markets and what we're seeing in the real economy there. Do you understand this as just being perhaps market sensitivity to the influence of the Chinese Communist Party, regulatory risk? How are you reading all of this China issue, Chris?
Yeah, you're completely correct. On the one hand, you've got this increasing regulatory burden, the Chinese government clamping down on companies, specifically those with foreign listing and foreign interest. But on the other hand, you've got an absolutely rampant economy. Now, the Chinese economy is expected to grow by over 8.5% this year and 5.5% the year after. In addition to that, if you look at Chinese industrial company profits, they're up 35% year on year. And we could argue that the base last year was affected by COVID, so perhaps we should compare it to 2019 levels. Well, industrial profits are up 45% relative to 2019 levels. So you've got this absolutely rampant growth in that underlying market, but you've got to offset that against increasing regulatory risk. It makes it very tricky to try to get an estimate of what fair value is for Chinese entities.
Yeah, and I think the market participants are just saying, well, we can't do that at this stage. So voting with their feet on that. If those regulatory risks do recede, I think there's a lot of value to be had in China. I've also been surprised by the low volatility numbers that we're seeing in the market. Do you think complacency creeping in real known risks that the market can see, at least apart from the inflation debate that we're having? How do you read that low vol number?
Yeah, this is completely bizarre. If you look at volatility in the US market, so simply moves in the market from day to day, it's very low. And if you look at implied volatility, which is the expected volatility over the next month, it's roughly in line with the 10-year median. So market participants are saying, well, there's no more uncertainty now than the average over the past few years. But we know that there is uncertainty. We know there's uncertainty with regards to the inflation outlook. We know there's uncertainty with regards to when the Fed is going to respond. And we know that there's uncertainty with regards to fiscal impulses in general. And so with all of that, you would think that expected volatility would be higher than normal. Mm. And that's not the case in the US. It's in line. And if you look at other parts of the world, like Europe, emerging markets, and currency markets, expected vol is actually at the bottom quartile of what we've seen over the past decade. And it does suggest some degree of complacency that's currently priced into equity markets and currency markets across the globe.
Retail traders blame the Our Wall Street Bets crowd. Now, locally, the economy continues to churn out encouraging macro numbers. How are you tracking on government revenue? Tax filing season has now opened, and I was chatting to Commissioner Keyswetter recently about tax morality. He's seeing surprisingly good tax morality, considering all of the corruption scandals and everything else we're seeing. What are you seeing on the revenue side?
Yeah, this is the story to keep an eye on in South Africa. We've seen a massive boom to our exports because of what's happened to global commodity prices, and now that is being translated into higher tax revenue for the state. And last year, the total tax revenue for the state surprised relative to the February budget by 40 billion rand. That is the numbers that they received by the end of March compared to their forecast in February. Compared to the forecast in October, it was 140 billion rand above the expectation. So it was a massive surprise, and that obviously helps the state. It means they can issue less debt, it means they can have tax reductions, and in fact, they can spend a bit more as well. Now, if we track the latest numbers that are coming through, it's very early days. We've only got data for 2 months out of the state's financial year. But nonetheless, those 2 months were pretty good. And based on the latest data, and if we were to annualize this, taking into account the fact that tax revenues are much higher in June and December than they are in other months, we put that into our forecast, it looks so far like tax revenue is running another 100 billion rand above the February forecast. Now, we need to wait until June till we get the June numbers to have a more precise forecast. And actually, if we want to be totally precise, we probably need to wait for the December numbers. But it is important to note that these numbers are running well ahead of schedule as we speak. And the key issue for the state is going to be to decide what they do with this excess and how to allocate it, whether it should be less debt or more spending or tax cut or any combination of them. I'm sure that's going to be a talking point, but it's a good problem to have.
And hopefully this turns into a trend of under-promising and over-delivering, because for the last decade it's been the other way around. And if you can start stacking these things up and take advantage of the commodity super cycle, as per the President's weekly missive, then we are on a much better footing and trajectory. There are still major issues when it comes to mining and the mining mafia. So force majeure, Transnet, and the coal line issues. There's a whole stack of issues in the mining sector that still need to be sorted out. But still, I don't want to be churlish. The trend is certainly with us at the moment. With the images, as I said earlier, Chris, of burning oceans, heat domes in the Northern Hemisphere, and record temperatures in Canada, the global economy, I see, could lose 10% of its total economic value by 2050, according to a new report from Swiss Re. How are you reading these risks for business as we head into those all-important Glasgow talks at the end of the year?
You know, climate change is something we increasingly need to incorporate into our investment process. You need to do it from a bottom-up level with regards to carbon emissions from individual companies and the possibility of higher taxes down the line and other costs, as well as from a top-down perspective, looking at individual countries and regions that are at greater risk than others. And so something we keep a very close eye on. The latest data suggests that the cities that are most risk from climate change going forward are largely in Asia, and it is something that we would need to discount when we're looking at regions like that to invest, because we know that there are risks should we land up with more variable climate. I mean, we've seen what's happened in parts of the US lately, and it does have implications for investment in general. So we're signatories to the PRI, and it's something that we take very seriously.
And in the Swiss Re report, China is at risk of losing nearly a quarter of its GDP in the severe scenario that is being played out. So that is extremely material to an investment thesis, and maybe another part of the market not quite fully buying into the Chinese economy at this stage. That's the Animal Spirits with Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investments. It's obviously worth bearing in mind what Jason Zweig writes about the art of forecasting in the Devil's Financial Dictionary. It's a noun meaning the attempt to predict the unknowable by measuring the irrelevant, a task that in one way or another employs most people on Wall Street.